Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Patrick of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who assesses the response to the Florida school massacre and the prospect that student activism could help weaken the NRA's power to block new gun control measures. Mary Sweeters with Greenpeace USA, who talks about what environmental groups and their allies are doing to fight the Trump administration's plan to open up 90% of America's coastlines to oil and gas drilling. And Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado, who discusses his recent article titled, "A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power." But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The British aid group Oxfam is in crisis over claims that its former director in Haiti hosted sex parties with prostitutes in the aftermath of that nation's massive 2010 earthquake. Public disclosure of the scandal in the Times of London led to the resignation of Oxfam's deputy chief executive, Penny Lawrence, and the group has lost high-profile supporters, including South African anti-apartheid leader Desmond Tutu. A former Oxfam internal investigator, Helen Evans, complained of a culture of sexual abuse, maintaining that within the agency, top Oxfam officials didn't take allegations of abuse seriously. A 2011 Oxfam investigation led to the resignation of the group's Haiti director, Ronald Van Houwer-Mayrin, and termination of other aid workers. Van Houwer-Mayrin was recently linked to other sex abuse allegations in both Chad and Liberia. Oxfam's international director, Winnie Byanyima, promised an independent inquiry into the failure of the group's investigation into allegations of sexual abuse in 2011. She also pledged that Oxfam will triple its budget for internal investigations and upgrade protections for whistleblowers. In early January, Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed a 2013 Obama administration memo directing the U.S. Justice Department to respect the recent liberalization of state marijuana laws. Now Sessions, the Justice Department, and the Drug Enforcement Agency are in court defending its crackdown on cannabis against a wide-ranging lawsuit filed by plaintiffs ranging from a U.S. military veteran to a former pro football player. The Christian Science Monitor reports that some U.S. attorneys may go the extreme route to target growers, dispensers, and users in states that have legalized cannabis, but other U.S. attorneys have signaled they are reluctant to interfere with state marijuana laws. The Massachusetts U.S. attorney, for example, has refused to declare his intent, which could complicate a summer deadline for the state to legalize recreational marijuana sales passed by voter referendum. Today, legal marijuana is a multi-billion-dollar industry from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. In recent years, 29 states have legalized the medical use of marijuana, while 8 have legalized the drug's recreational use. A Gallup poll in January found that for the first time, just over half of all Republicans, 51%, support legalization of recreational marijuana. Overall, 94% of Americans support medical marijuana, according to a 2017 Quinnipiac poll. Midwest progressives have launched a major campaign to defeat Democratic Congressman Dan Lipinski, who represents Chicago's blue-collar Southwest side. For a generation, the socially conservative Lipinski family has held Illinois' 3rd congressional district seat. A leader of the Blue Dog Coalition of conservative Democrats, Lipinski opposes women's reproductive rights, Obamacare, and a path to citizenship for DACA recipients. Progressives are backing businesswoman Marie Newman, who supports Medicare for All, a $15 an hour minimum wage, and worker rights. In addition to picking up the endorsements of Democracy for America and MoveOn.org, Newman won the backing of New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who hosted a Chicago campaign fundraiser for the candidate. Lipinski supporters include billionaire Jerry Reinsdorf, a major donor of Illinois' right-wing Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. During last year's presidential primary, Bernie Sanders won the district by 8 points, signaling a leftward shift. A month before the March 20th primary, the Newman campaign's internal polls find that the first-time candidate is now leading Lipinski by 5 points. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In one of the deadliest mass shooting incidents in the U.S., 17 people were killed and 15 were wounded at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th. Police say 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz entered the school armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle, a gas mask, smoke grenades, and multiple magazines of ammunition, and shot students and teachers after pulling a fire alarm in the building. The group Every Town for Gun Safety reports that since 2013, there have been nearly 300 school shootings in America, an average of about one a week. The massacre in South Florida has reignited the long-running national debate on the need to establish stricter controls on the sale of firearms and who can purchase them. During the years of Republican control of Congress, legislators have refused to strengthen background checks for gun buyers or reimpose a ban on military-style assault weapons. In fact, following the National Rifle Association's agenda, Congress passed and Donald Trump signed a law reversing an Obama administration initiative that made it harder for people with mental illness to buy a gun. But a surprising new force has arisen from the Florida school shooting tragedy. Students at the Parkland School, through their grief and pain, have staged powerful protests against Congress and their own state legislature for their failure to address gun violence. Students and their allies are now organizing nationwide school walkouts on March 14th and April 20th, and a March 24th protest rally is planned in Washington, D.C., and other cities across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Patrick, media director with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Here he assesses the response to the Florida school shooting and the prospect that new student activism could help break the deadlock in Congress.
In June 2016, we saw Orlando, which surpassed Virginia Tech as the most horrific mass shooting. Then just last October, we saw the Las Vegas and then the deadliest church shooting in Sutherland Springs. And now we have the deadliest high school shooting. And it is horrific and awful and horrible to see every single time. The scenes are all too familiar of children running out of a school like it's a war zone. The breaking news alerts, terrified parents, it's kind of become a unfortunate, awful part of American life. The difference is this time we have seen this rapid movement take place grassroots by these students who have been incredibly passionate, but also very smart and very savvy and very poised in their response to this. And that not only has kept us talking about the issue of gun violence, but also it feels like there is a real movement afoot to actually make some changes.
Andrew, what's the difference? What provoked, you think, these students, unlike others in previous horrendous mass murder incidents? Why do you think they've taken a different route to dealing with their mourning of their fellow students, but also anger, which has fueled their action and calls for mass demonstrations across the country?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. These students, if you were a sophomore or a freshman in this high school, you would have been in elementary school when Sandy Hook happened 5 years ago. So this is an issue that they've grown up with, this horror of this unique horror of American life that they've seen. And I think there is just to be able to have a student-led, grassroots-led group come out. I mean, I'm sure they're talking to some of the other groups, but I mean, this is really being led, and it's their voices, it's their words, it's their passion, and it's remarkable to see. And everyone, I mean, from the president, according to reports, to parents across the country, to gun owners, to NRA members, are really hearing them. And it's something that we really haven't quite seen before. Everyone thought Sandy Hook was going to be the turning point, and it was in many ways. It built the current movement we're seeing now. But Sandy Hook turned out to be the catalyst, and now we're actually starting to get to a place where people are really becoming single-issue voters and activists on this year-round, not just following a horrific tragedy.
After so many mass shooting incidents, there are many people in the country who are cynical that any action will be forthcoming from Congress, because the recent history shows that Congress, dominated by Republicans, many of whom get a lot of their campaign contributions from the National Rifle Association, has effectively blocked any action on the part of Congress, including stopping people on the terrorist watch list from purchasing guns. Just an amazing number of proposals have been blocked. Is there any reason to hope that things will be different this time?
Well, I think, and you saw this movement kind of start to take place after the Las Vegas shooting. It's not just that these bills are being introduced, it's that they're bipartisan bills. The Fix NICS Act that came up after the Sutherland Springs shooting that would improve our federal background check system, because our background checks, it's good to have them, but they're only work as well as the information we put in there. It turned out in that case that the proper information was not carried over to stop that person from getting a gun. It is a bill from Senator Cornyn of Texas, Senator Hatch of Utah, and the two senators from Connecticut. It is a bipartisan bill, and we're looking at real solutions in Congress, but also at the state level, which is where most of this action is going to take place. Congress has a difficult time passing a budget. They have a difficult time keeping the government open. They have a difficult time passing farm bills. Tackling gun violence is an incredibly hard and complicated issue that requires broad support from both sides. And with all these mass shootings, we're slowly starting to take these modest steps to get there. So we're hopeful that some of these laws, maybe an ending the ban on the CDC ban on research, is another thing that we, I think, could attract bipartisan support. And these bills in and of themselves are not going to stop all gun violence. No one's saying that. What we're saying is these are steps moving in the right direction. And then hopefully down the line, we can really start to see some of these more comprehensive universal background checks, assault weapons bans. At least the discussion is taking place. So in a Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate, these are good signs, because we thought we were going to be playing defense on bad NRA bills this entire session of Congress. And it turns out we're actually starting to push some of the items that we'd like to see.
That was Andrew Patrick, media director with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the student actions and the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 8th, the Trump administration released its five-year draft plan to open up 90% of all coastlines around the U.S. to oil and gas drilling, with just a small part of Alaska and Hawaii's coastlines not included in the plan. Soon after the directive was released, Rick Scott, the Republican governor of Florida, requested an exemption, citing the uniqueness of the state's coastline that would be at risk if an oil spill accident occurred. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke famously granted the exemption request via a tweet. The requested exemption, however, is not a done deal, as the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has not signed off on it. Meanwhile, many other governors of coastline states have also asked for exemptions. The Trump administration's move to open up most of America's coastal areas to oil and gas drilling was met with immediate and widespread opposition. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mary Sweeters, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA, who talks about what environmental groups and their allies are doing to fight the oil drilling plan and the next steps in the campaign.
When this proposed plan came out in January, that initiated a 60-day comment period, in which time the public has the opportunity to comment on this proposed plan, as well as legislators, interest organizations, the industry. Anybody can kind of weigh in on it. And we've actually seen a lot of opposition already. There have been rallies and kind of big turnout, some of the hearings that were scheduled in each state. In fact, here in California, we had, you know, over 500 people show up to Sacramento last week. Some people came in on buses from all over the state. Similar rallies have been happening along coastal states everywhere. We've also seen bipartisan opposition to the proposed plan. Governors and legislators on both sides of the aisle have stated their opposition to this. Thousands of businesses have come out against offshore drilling on both the Atlantic and the Pacific coast. So there's definitely been a real sense of opposition to this that's been organized and vocal from the start.
And approval of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge took place a few weeks before this draft plan was put out as part of the tax cut package, after decades of successful efforts to prevent the drilling there. What's happening with that?
as it is with offshore drilling, there are folks in Alaska and across the country who are getting ready to, you know, have protested this, want to protect this place. It is a sacred place for the Gwich'in people who rely on the health of the porcupine caribou herd for their culture and livelihood. It's a place for, you know, a lot of people visit for recreation. It's an incredible, unique ecosystem. And a lot of people have fought for decades to protect this place and will continue to do so. So right now, it just sort of remains to be seen what's the next step in terms of when there will be proposals for exploration. And those will also include, I believe, comment periods and opportunities for an environmental review that's necessary for exploration to begin.
Mary Sweeters, what is Greenpeace doing to oppose this? And are you working in coalition with other groups?
We've been doing a few things. We have been helping to mobilize our supporters and our members to these public hearings in multiple states. We've also been working to make it as easy as we can to let folks know, here's what's on the table. Here's how you can, you know, make sure to submit your public comment. We've connected folks to the representatives to make sure that they can contact their representatives to vote no on some bad proposed bills around offshore drilling. We've also joined with a number of other organizations on a lawsuit to uphold permanent protections in the Arctic and Atlantic Ocean, because those are also being jeopardized by the executive order that the Trump administration released last year. And as part of that proposed five-year plan would jeopardize those protections.
Well, what about the Pacific Ocean?
The lawsuit that we joined with a number of other organizations, that's specifically to uphold the permanent protections that were put in place by the Obama administration for about 98% of the federal waters in the Arctic Ocean and for an important area along the Atlantic that would protect underwater seamounts and kind of a unique ecosystem in that area. And those areas were permanently withdrawn from any sort of consideration for leasing. And so we want to ensure that those specific protections were in place. In addition to that, we're also certainly mobilizing folks and making sure people know how to contact the administration to protect all of our waters from this five-year drilling proposal.
A subset of opponents is focused on the impacts on sea life from the drilling and everything that goes along with that. That's a big issue, right?
Actually, a precursor to offshore drilling is what's called seismic blasting or seismic airgun blasting. And this is the process to find where there are oil and gas deposits under the seabed floor. And this is a very loud process and involves shooting compressed air toward the seafloor every 10 to 20 seconds for sometimes days or weeks at a time over a huge swath of ocean. And this has been shown to cause harm and even death to marine mammals, as well as plankton all the way down at the base of the food chain. So it's very much a concern for the health of fisheries and for the general ecosystem. But then, aside from seismic blasting, when oil drilling starts, you certainly have the risk of oil spills, which would affect wildlife such as the endangered northern Atlantic right whale in the Atlantic Ocean, the Arctic marine ecosystem, which, as we know, is very unique and also very fragile. There's polar bears, beluga, an assortment of marine mammals that are found nowhere else that would be at great risk from an oil spill. Same in the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific. They all have their own unique ecosystems, and those wildlife would be at, you know, inevitable risk from an oil spill. But on top of that, this is locking us into decades of climate change emissions. So this is something that we already know these ecosystems are in peril from climate change. We're seeing the Arctic melting at a rate about twice the rate of the rest of the globe. And we know that this climate change is affecting our ocean ecosystems significantly. And so offshore oil drilling will just lock us into more of those climate emissions that we just can't afford.
That was Mary Sweeters, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is holding one hearing in each state on the Trump administration's oil drilling proposal. And the public has until March 9th to send in their comments. For additional information on the campaign opposing expanded oil drilling on America's coasts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Contemporary peace and social movements in the U.S., from the millions who rallied to fight for civil rights and racial justice, and those that mobilized to oppose the Vietnam War and subsequent American interventions abroad often look to history for guidance on how to effect change. In a recent article, Nathan Schneider, assistant professor in media studies at the University of Colorado and author, examined some of the lessons today's progressive activists can learn from the populist movements of the late 19th century. In his article titled, "A Populism of Hope Begins When People Feel Their Own Power," Schneider recounts how white and black farmers from the American South and West revolted against the financial power of urban robber barons that included financier J.P. Morgan, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, and Standard Oil's John D. Rockefeller. Schneider notes that it was not grievances against an unfair economic system alone that stimulated the farmers' movement to grow and go on to win victories. Rather, he points out, that the farmers' creation of cooperatives served as an engine of counter-economy, which became a source of inspiration and a means of material support. Farmers of the populist era, who eventually made common cause with the largest labor union of that time, used their cooperatives, known as the Farmers' Alliance, to bypass the economic monopolies of the robber barons, using their collective power to purchase supplies, sell their products, and extend credit to their own members. Your reporter spoke with Nathan Schneider, who explains why he believes that popular social movements through history have needed to create their own alternative systems and models of empowerment in order to inspire success.
Turning back to that moment really started for me the morning after the election of Donald Trump as president. I'd had for some weeks a book on my bedstand called The Populist Moment by Goodwin, and just that title kind of grabbed me after that election and made me curious to go back to other populist moments, moments where people in one form or another turned against an elite. And what I found in that story was a very different kind of populist moment, a very, very different one, one that arose out of a lot of the same concerns. In the late 19th century, it was not financialization of everything in Silicon Valley and automation and globalization. It was railroads and oil and urban bankers. And the ways that people resisted first began with developing their own economic alternatives, developing cooperatives, developing their own tools and organizations, unions in the city, especially through the Knights of Labor in the countryside. It was through the Grange or the Farmers Alliance. And what resulted in the form of the Populist Party in the late 1880s and early 1890s was a populism that was fueled by people's sense of their own power, their own capacity to change the world around them through those economic alternatives. And it resulted in a really different set of policies, a more hopeful set of ambition. And, you know, one example of that is in 1893, the year after the populists elected their own governor to the state of Colorado here, Colorado became one of the first states to pass women's suffrage. That's one of many ways in which this movement envisioned a much more hopeful future than I think the populism of today does.
Nathan, turning to the contemporary scene where so many people have reached their limits and are quite upset and angry about their economic futures and their children's economic futures in this current system. What is going on today that you feel parallels some of the creative institution building that was going on in the populist era? Are there contemporary examples of new movements that have developed? I would just point to two that I'm familiar with and our listeners maybe because they've been guests on this program over the years, and that is Gar Alperovitz, a professor, has joined with other people in terms of forming something they call the Democracy Collaborative. And Richard Wolff, who has a radio show and is widely known for his groundbreaking work on progressive economic alternatives, he's got an organization called Democracy at Work. Those are just two examples, and I'm sure you have many more that you can share with us.
Absolutely. There's a new generation of people who are pouring into this cooperative movement, turning to it almost as if they're starting by scratch often. And this is really the subject of my next book, which is coming out later this year, called Everything for Everyone. And it's a kind of chronicle of the movement that I've been exploring since seeing it emerge out of Occupy Wall Street and the movement, the protest movements of that period, where groups from Occupy Wall Street, from the movements around Europe that came around the same time, out of Black Lives Matter, you had people, young people, turning to this cooperative model again, and they're finding success all over the country. Cities all over the country are starting to implement the necessary enabling policies to help support worker ownership at a moment where workers are being kind of pressed from all sides. And we see a lot of new formations starting to emerge. I've been working very much in the realm of what we call platform cooperatives, which is cooperative models in the online economy. And so, you know, every day I'm talking with entrepreneurs around the world who are trying to build successful online businesses that really put people first before investor profits. And it's really exciting to see that. One organization I would add to your list there is the New Economy Coalition, which has become in the United States a really vital container for this kind of work. And one thing that they do really well, I think, is put a range of issues at the center, especially racial justice, gender justice, a range of concerns in addition to economic democracy that help these kinds of models really address the vital concerns that people are facing right now.
That was Nathan Snyder, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, and God in Proof. Find a link to Snyder's articles and essays by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, WTND in Macon, Illinois, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.